Today is Thursday, February 20th. We're going to work on page 51 with blood vessels. Okay, so this is going to serve as a review for us for Tuesday's content. So we've got an artery on the right and a vein on the left. You may notice that there's some blood inside both of those vessels. That's what all this is red blood cells inside. And you'll notice that this artery has a tunica intima here, which kind of looks like it's relaxed, a fairly thick tunica media, and this would be our tunica adventitia traveling around the outside. When you look at the vein, what do you notice about the tunica media?
Not much.
So veins don't have a very thick middle layer. That's that tunica media layer. And we typically find smooth muscle there, and maybe what kind of fibers? Well, we have elastic there, and in the adventitia on the outside, that's where you find, there's your collagen, yeah. So in a vein, we don't really have much pressure, so there's not much need for a lot of stretchiness, and that's why you see a thinner wall here. We're not really conducting blood under high pressure. In fact, the smooth muscle that's found in a vein is all about helping to pump blood along because it's under low pressure. Okay, so interesting here to think about this. Arteries have high pressure. They have to have strong walls. They need to have stretchy walls. And they also need to be able to contract to either restrict blood flow to a certain location, or they need to be able to relax and open up and allow blood to flow to a certain location. Okay, veins are different. Veins are just pipes that take blood back to the heart. But the problem is, you know, there's gravity, this thing that keeps you grounded on Earth, right? So because of gravity, we actually have blood being pulled down toward our legs, and we have to fight that pull. So how do you get blood from your legs back to your heart using a vein?
Blood pressure.
And valves. And breathing, right? And movement. Because there's very little blood pressure here, that's not going to be a primary push behind this blood. The primary things that help your blood move back are going to be things like you simply moving about, valves preventing that backflow, respiration helps to create negative pressure. All that helps to pull the blood back. And the fact that we've got muscle here that helps contract and push that blood along. Okay, so the muscle serves two different functions in an artery versus a vein. In an artery, muscle actually helps us control where the blood goes, you know, restricting blood flow or increasing blood flow. But in veins, it's all about maintaining that pressure, helping to pump that blood back to the heart. So that's why moving about, breathing, valves are really helping us out with this return back up to our heart. You know, that's several feet that you got to work against, you know, in terms of getting it to move from your feet back to your heart. Okay, so let's make sure we've got the blank on the bottom of your page filled in. Very bottom of 51, small veins are called what?
Venules.
Good. You can see these teeny tiny arterioles and venules for comparison. They are just smaller in diameter than your typical artery or vein. And smallest of them all is the capillary. So if you'll flip over to 53 with me, or sorry, 52. These teeny tiny capillaries are composed only of one cell layer thickness, and that is tunica intima. That is tunica intima. Only composed of one cell layer thick, and that is tunica intima. These capillaries serve as networks throughout your cells and tissues. Pretty much every cell or tissue has to be in close proximity to capillaries because this is how we serve our cells and tissues with oxygenated blood, and it's also how we pick up waste carbon dioxide. And the way we do this gas exchange is because we've got a really thin wall for our capillary. It's only one cell layer thick, so it's easy for gases to diffuse across that single cell layer. In this picture, you'll notice a cell traveling through. It looks like a white blood cell, and it fills the entire inside of that capillary. That drives home how small diameter these capillaries are. they're only big enough for a cell to go through single file. In fact, red blood cells will bend on themselves, kind of fold up like a frisbee, and then they flex back open after they travel through a really tight set of capillary beds. I should also mention this. There's some other ones, pretty cool looking. Capillaries actually exist in beds like you see here. They're networks that serve a set of tissues or cells. And you'll notice that the color here changes from red to blue. What's happening is blood travels from an arterial through a capillary bed to the venule. Using up the oxygen. Yeah, it's going out to cells and tissues. What are we picking up?
CO2.
Picking up CO2, right. And anything else you want to exchange, whether it's giving glucose to your cells, giving other nutrients to your cells, hormones can hop out here at the capillary beds. We can also pick up any waste products at this capillary exchange. So it's great that we have this network of capillaries in order for us to do exchanges. Gas exchange, nutrients, waste products can occur all here at this capillary bed. And since we're doing exchanges, we might need a way for the substances in the blood to escape. If you really want to make the exchange with your surrounding cells and tissues easy, what should you do to your capillary structure? Should you poke holes in it or keep it closed? If you really want the exchange to occur, poke holes in it, right? So, you ever heard of a garden hose that has those holes perforated all through it? You lay those garden hoses out, turn the water on, and it leaks all over your plants. That's what these open fenestrated capillaries are. They're leaky, and they've got these little holes or openings all through their lymph. And that's great if you want to do an exchange with your environment. So you probably heard of the liver being a really important organ. It's more than just a digestive organ. It has capillaries like that that allow for a great deal of exchange. So we want what's in the blood to be exchanged with the surrounding cells and tissues. Back in Bio210, though, you also heard about the blood-brain barrier. So what was special about the blood-brain barrier?
It's your firewall.
It's your firewall. Great way to put it. You do not want certain things, most things, in fact, to escape the blood in your capillaries and get into the brain tissue. So in those cases where you've got, like, you know, blood-brain barrier, you actually have what we call a closed capillary network. And that way we don't have blood leaking out into those surrounding cells and tissues. In fact, this is what we call a tight junction setup. You know, you've got tight junctions here that prevent any leakage into those surrounding cells and tissues. So boy, we go from wanting to have a great exchange with fenestrated capillaries to wanting no exchange with a set of closed capillaries. Let's talk also about how you might deal with tissues that you do or do not want to get blood. If you've ever had a bruise, nasty, bad bruise, you might have grabbed a pack of ice and put it on your bruise. What did that help do? Make your swelling go down, right? And we know that swelling is inflammation, and there's four cardinal signs of inflammation. One is swelling, right? And then hot, what else?
Red
and pain. So, you know, an ice pack is great for helping to reduce some of those symptoms. What in effect putting pressure or an ice pack can do, it can activate these sphincters that you see here that sit around the capillary bed. What you're hoping to do with that ice pack is, you know, freeze those capillaries. And if you shut off these blood flows through these capillary beds, what are you ultimately going to reduce happening around those beds? No more swelling, right? So shut off the capillaries, reduce the blood flow, and now what color does your skin appear? Not reddish.
Brown, blue.
Yeah, could be blue. Could be lighter than it was to begin with because you're starving those tissues of oxygenated blood. But that may be the intended effect, right? Because you're trying to reduce the swelling. Sometimes, however, we don't necessarily want to ice a certain area. Sometimes we want to increase the blood flow. And if you're using a hot heat pack or a heating pad, what happens to these sphincters here?
They open them up,
right. And what do you want to happen as blood flows from arterial to venule?
More exchange.
Yeah, you want blood to flood that area. So that'll make that particular area warmer because you've got more blood flowing through. So if you've ever had maybe wisdom tooth surgery or some other surgery where they say alternate heat and cold, you know, the cold prevents the swelling, right? And then the heat promotes the swelling. So by going back and forth, you increase the blood flow, but the cold decreases the blood flow. And we do that by activating those sphincters on those capillary beds. So temperature is just one reason we might want to use capillary sphincters to either regulate an increase or a decrease of blood flow to a certain area of your body. All right. So on your worksheet there, about midway down, you'll notice there is a systemic pathway and a pulmonary pathway, just as a way of review. And I just want to remind you that gas exchange occurs at which set of vessels in both pathways?
Capillaries,
good. Now, they work in opposite to each other. So let's talk about the systemic pathway. When blood leaves the aorta, is that blood oxygenated or deoxygenated?
Oxygenated.
So when we go from the aorta to arteries, arterioles, and capillaries, it is the oxygen that we're delivering to cells and tissues. Oxygen actually leaves our capillaries and diffuses into cells. But there's a waste product waiting to be picked up at our capillaries. What waste product is that?
Carbon dioxide.
So we now load carbon dioxide into our capillaries, and it's transported in venules, veins, SVC, IVC. Where are we back to?
Right atrium.
So that systemic pathway is one that we give away the oxygen. We say we unload it to our cells and tissues, and we're loading in that waste product to come back to the heart and lungs. Now, hold that thought and then look at the pulmonary circuit. When we take blood from the right ventricle over to the lungs, we're taking what type of blood?
Deoxygenated.
And that means there's low oxygen but high levels of
CO2,
carbon dioxide. You'll notice that we go from pulmonary arteries to the lungs. We do a gas exchange in those capillaries. And now, this time, we're getting rid of which one?
CO2.
So now you unload the CO2, let it diffuse out of your capillaries, and when you breathe in, you're bringing in oxygen. And oxygen now is loaded into your capillaries. That, of course, comes back by pulmonary venules, pulmonary veins, and what chamber do we arrive back in?
Left atrium,
good. So I just want to point out the obvious, and that is these capillaries are doing an opposite exchange. Where we load oxygen and unload oxygen is different depending on where you're talking about in the body. So just wanted to kind of, you know, sprinkle that thought in your brain because it will make a big difference for us as we move into respiratory. How about questions so far on capillaries? Is everything okay so far today? Whoops. Not that slide. Okay, anything I can hit for you before we step into physiology? Any old topics you need to hear again? Which one?
Cardiac cycle?
Sure. Let's see, I think it was that PowerPoint. Nope. Diastole, systole, that stuff.
Yeah.
Okay.
Further than that. Yeah.
This stuff.
We talk about the ESV. And
that stuff.
Yeah.
Okay. So the calculations more so than.
Just the cycle, what the valves are doing each cycle.
The isometric.
Yeah.
All right, let's start there, and we'll pull those two slides. Okay, so we're taking a pause and going back. This is heart number two PowerPoint. Okay, so we're looking at cardiac cycle. And if you want to go back with me, we are 42, that sounds great. Okay. Okay, so we're going to start in a time period that is a relaxation time period. We call this mid to late diastole. And by not specifying whether I'm talking about ventricles or atria, your assumption should be I'm talking about what?
Ventricles,
right. So mid to late diastole is technically mid to late ventricular diastole. And at this time, blood is flowing from the pulmonary veins back into the left atrium, and it's flowing from SVC, IVC, coronary sinus back into the
right
atrium. Good. Blood flows through open AV valves. You'll notice here at mid to late diastole, those valves are currently open, but the semilunars, you'll notice, are currently closed. Okay? And so we never have all four valves open at the same time, but there is actually two split-second time periods where all four valves are going to be closed. Right now, however, we've got the atrioventricular valve sitting there open. About this time, the SA node fires an impulse. That tells your two atria to depolarize and contract, and the blood that forces down into each ventricle is called the end diastolic volume. Okay, so we're at the end of the ventricle's diastole. How much blood enters each ventricle right now? 120 milliliters, okay? So atria just squeezed, they forced their remaining blood down into the ventricles, and of course each ventricle holds an end diastolic volume of about 120 milliliters, okay? We are in a time period called diastole. It is low pressure in the heart. So if we're looking at a pressure like 120 over 80, then that 80 number is the pressure of the atria just contracting. Whoa, what? Okay, so when those atria contract, specifically that left atrium, when it contracts, it's fairly low pressure, 70 or 80 millimeters mercury is atrial systole, which is the same thing as ventricular diastole. Yep. So just got to keep in mind, you know, where our perspective is at that time. Now, the nerve impulse will reach your SA node, and of course, the SA node fires an impulse that travels down a bundle, and then it splits into what?
Bundle
branches. And of course, that comes up the walls and these ventricles and terminates with?
Purkinje
fibers. Good. Now, those ventricles start to depolarize, they begin to contract, and in slow motion, as they begin to contract, capillary muscles and little fingers that stick up in here, they're going to pull down on which valves?
AV
valves. They will be pulled, slamming them shut, and that creates a noise. That noise is
love.
Right, it's a long love noise. Okay. Pause right here. You have all four valves currently closed. You know that anytime all four valves are closed, it's called isovolumetric. Well, the trick is it isovolumetric contraction or isovolumetric relaxation?
Contraction.
It's contraction. Good. Because what are we getting ready to do in the ventricles?
Contract.
Right. So because we're in the process of contracting, this very short time period is isovolumetric contraction phase. The pressure here is high, especially in that left ventricle. During systole, what is left ventricle pressure?
110, 120,
good. And so that pressure is now so high, we only have one route to escape, and it is not to go backwards through those 80 valves, but rather we force open which valves?
Semilunar
valves, good. So semilunars now are forced open, and each ventricle pumps out or ejects a stroke volume of 70, Right, so 70 milliliters is pumped out during stroke volume. Hey, just for fun, we know we said the left ventricle was, say, 110, 120 millimeters pressure. When the right ventricle contracts, what is its pressure?
20?
Yeah, 24, exactly. It's a really, really low pressure. So we're not having to pump too hard, because where does right ventricle send blood? To the lungs. And left ventricle sends blood to the body. Good. Okay, so slow-mo with me here. The right and left ventricle contract. They force blood up through these now open semilunar valves. 70 milliliters escapes each ventricle. That's our stroke volume. And it's going out through the aorta and out through the pulmonary trunk. Because the pressure is now dropping, those two semilunar valves now slam shut. And it's a real quick duck sound when they slam shut. Now that they are shut, that is our second heart sound, and it's our second opportunity for an isovolumetric phase. We have not yet reopened these AV valves, right? Okay, so because these semilunars slam shut right before the AVs open, is this isovolumetric contraction or relaxation?
Relaxation.
Yeah, because the heart's going back into ventricular diastole from the systolic period, and you're right, we're now relaxing once again. Also, each ventricle is left with a certain volume of blood. How much blood is in each ventricle right now?
50 milliliters.
Good, 50 milliliters, and that's called our?
End-systolic
volume, good, or ESV for short, good. Well, we now have those little finger-like papillary muscles start to relax, and when they relax, they allow which valves to reopen once more?
AV
valves. So AV valves now reopen. Keep in mind your semilunars are closed once again. We are now done with ventricular systole, and we're heading back into our relaxation period known as diastole. Okay? So, boy, this took several minutes to talk through, but in reality, a resting heart does this whole cycle in how long?
0.8 seconds,
right? And that's assuming a heart rate of how many beats per minute? 75. Good. Do it again? Yes? Okay. All right. I'm going to talk less this time. Okay. Blood comes into the right atrium and the left atrium under low pressure. This is during diastole, that's relaxation, okay? So where is blood being drained from that comes to the right atrium? Good, SVC, IVC, coronary sinus. Left atrium gets blood from pulmonary veins, good. Blood drains through open valves. They are called?
AV
valves, right. And that blood drains into our two ventricles, good. What node fires about this time?
SA.
Good. Causing what chambers to contract?
The atria.
The atria, yeah. They both atria now contract and they squeeze simultaneously. That forces any remaining blood down through open
AV
valves and it collects in those two ventricles. How much blood now collects in each ventricle? Good. And that's a volume known as?
End diastolic.
End diastolic, right? Because we're at the end of diastole because our perspective is the ventricles are resting, okay? So 120 mils in each ventricle. About that time, the nerve impulse arrives at your AV node. It travels down
the
bundle of His.
Branches.
Good. And we tell the ventricles to
contract.
Right. And as they depolarize, preparing to contract, you see a really big wave on the EKG called
QRS
wave. Good. Now, as the ventricles contract, we go into slow-mo, and we're now pulling down on those heartstrings, slamming shut which valves?
AV
valves. All four valves are currently closed, called? Good, isovolumetric contraction phase. Now, the pressure is great, the pressure is rising, and of course, we've got to let the blood escape some route, so which valves are now open? Semilunar valves, good. When the heart contracts, both ventricles pump blood simultaneously up through the aorta and pulmonary trunk. And that ejection volume is known as?
Stroke volume.
Good. And it's how much?
70
milliliters. And a good ejection fraction is about how much percent?
60.
Yeah, 50, 60%, somewhere in that range. Technically, they say 50 to 65%. Now that you've just ejected blood during ventricular systole, you're left behind with a little bit of blood in each ventricle, a volume known as?
End-systolic volume.
Volume, right. And of course, that's about how much blood per ventricle?
50 milliliters.
50 milliliters, good. Now, pressure's dropping, okay? And we are no longer needing these semilunar valves standing wide open. So they slam shut, producing what noise?
Dub.
Right, so lub is the closure of your atrioventricular. Dub is the closure of your semilunar valves. All right, all four valves right now are currently closed. We're going into our diastole period, so this time period is called?
Isovolumetric
relaxation. That's it, isovolumetric relaxation phase, good. And pressure is starting to drop once again. Once those papillary muscles relax, we let go of those heartstrings, and then which valves now reopen?
80
valves now reopen. Good. Just for fun here, if you happen to have a valve that's faulty, you know, maybe a prolapse valve, one that's kind of drooping down into the ventricles, where would blood backflow if you had a drooping mitral valve prolapse? Back into the left atrium. What if you had a stenotic aortic valve? That means it's narrow. How would that influence, say, ejection fraction? Yeah, lower it, because you couldn't squeeze as much blood through if you had a tinier opening. How would that affect your stroke volume? It'd lower it. How would that affect your cardiac output? Lowers it. So all that stuff gets lowered if you've got a tiny little opening for that blood to flow through. If you've got left side heart failure, where do you see the problem?
In the lungs.
In the lungs, yeah. If you've got right side heart failure, where do you see the problem? All over the body, yeah. Body starts to swell. Okay. How are you feeling about this now?
Better.
Better. If you need to do it again Tuesday, just remind me. I'll be happy to run you back through. Okay. Anything else on the heart before we keep on trucking with blood vessels? Good? Okay. Okay, so bottom of page 52 talks about physiology of circulation. That's where we're heading. And our first term there is blood pressure. And if I had to think of one word for blood pressure, it would be force. So if I had to think of one word for blood pressure, it would be force. Well, technically, if I want to do the whole definition, it's actually the force or the push of fluid inside your blood against the walls of your vessels. So it's now time for us to go back and talk about blood once again. We know that blood is around what percent plasma? About 55%. And of course, 45% of blood is mostly
red blood cells.
So it is the fluid, that 55% of your plasma, that's pushing against the walls of your vessels. And that's creating the force or the pressure of the blood as it travels from arteries to arterioles to capillaries. The pressure really starts to give out by the time you get to your venules and veins. The force has lost its push. So that's why we need other things like movement and breathing and valves to help blood in those veins get back. There's just no pressure when you get to those veins. We do measure blood pressure in millimeters mercury. Of course, that is the force exerted by the blood in those arteries. And this picture here, which is actually in your worksheet on the top of page 53, you may want to keep 52 and 53 where you can either switch back and forth between them or see them both at the same time. Notice what happens to blood pressure in the aorta. It goes up to about 120, it goes down to about 80. So systolic pressure is somewhere around 110 or 120. Diastolic pressure is somewhere around 70 or 80. And you can see the pulsation of systolic and diastolic every time the heart pumps and moves that blood out. You get that oscillation of pressures back and forth until you get all the way through your elastic and muscular arteries until you reach those arterioles. So the point here is, if you want to feel the pulse, you can actually do that in aorta, elastic arteries, muscular arteries, and to some extent you start losing it there in the arterioles. By the time you get to the arterioles, you no longer get a really hard push for systolic pressure and a lighter push for diastolic pressure. You just get a steady flow of blood going through capillaries, venules, veins, and then back to the heart. So the point I'm trying to make here is, if you have any luck at detecting a pulse, it's got to be in one of these A's: arteries, arterioles, or even aorta. Okay, you're not going to get a pulse in the veins because there's just no pressure there. It's starting to drop off to zero. All right, so on your worksheet there, very bottom of page 52, looking at this chart, which vessel, and there's just one, experiences the highest blood pressure?
Aorta.
Aorta, good. If this was a roller coaster ride, where is your biggest drop?
Arterial.
Yep. Look at that massive drop in that arteriole. So that's your next question. The biggest drop-off comes in those arterioles. So let me put it to you this way. If you have a garden hose, let's just pretend it was a 100-foot garden hose. You know, by the time you get to the end, you're so far from the pressure that it comes out like a trickle. That's what the deal is here with arterioles. You are so far from the heart that the major push has just kind of started to wane off because you're getting really far from the source of our heart pumping. Another issue is arterioles are actually smaller in diameter than our arteries. So when you start changing the diameter, you start influencing how the pressure and the force of that blood travels through. All right, let's see. You'll notice that blood pressure is higher in capillary beds when it enters, lower when it leaves. But once you get to venules and veins, you're looking at pretty much a zero pressure for this blood. There's not any force there. The only way to get it back to the heart is through you moving, breathing, valves, and relying on the smooth muscle to help milk that blood back to the heart. So we're kind of out of pressure by that point. Okay, so highest pressure is in which vessel?
Aorta.
Good. And what would you say about the pressure in the SVC and IVC?
Low.
Yeah, zero, very low. Okay, and your steepest drop off?
Arterioles,
good. All right, so just for fun, we actually had this picture back in several pages ago. Just want to mention here, the American Heart Association actually recommends normal somewhere between 80 and 120. They actually say 110 is better than 120. And you'll notice that normal diastolic pressure is between 60 and 80. So, you know, used to 120 over 80 was like the going standard. It was the perfect blood pressure if there could be one. But, you know, now they say a little bit lower puts a little less pressure on the heart because the heart's not getting so much pumping activity with the lower pressure. You'll notice prehypertensive numbers are 120 to 140 roughly, above 80 for the diastolic. And then we start getting into high blood pressure. You'll notice that crisis sets in around 180 or higher on the systolic number and 110 or higher on the diastolic number. So those are, in fact, even lower. They used to say, you know, 190, 200 was dangerous. Now they're saying it's, you know, 180 being a bad number. I do want to mention the low blood pressure numbers there. Less than 80 for systolic and less than 60 for diastolic are roughly what they say to be problematic numbers, hypotensive numbers. So what is the problem with having a low blood pressure? Not getting enough oxygen, right? So when we talk about not pumping out enough blood, enough oxygen, how might you feel? Lightheaded?
Fatigued.
Yep. Maybe a little confused? Okay. So we're looking at problems delivering oxygen when you start getting blood pressure that's so low. Flip it, though. If you happen to have blood pressure that's too high, you probably are doing a great job oxygenating your body. But what does that do to your vessels when you have really high pressure?
Stretches
them, yeah. So imagine blood pressure being a bunch of fists going through your vessels. At normal pressure, it's just a gentle massage going through. But when you're talking about blood pressure like 180 over 110, it's a bunch of fists that are punching at the walls of your vessels. You're right, they stretch the vessels. And what happens if you punch a vessel really hard from the inside?
Rupture.
Or, yeah, hemorrhage, right. You could have damage like bruises, blood clots form. You could cause all sorts of problems if you continue to have this really high force of blood beating up the insides of your vessels. So I kind of think of it like fists that are punching when you've got high blood pressure. Okay, now it looks like we're ready for middle of page 53. So back in the previous chapter, we talked about cardiac output, and we said it's on average about 5 liters or so that are pumped by your heart per minute, and that is dependent upon two factors: our heart rate, which is around 75 beats per minute, and our stroke volume, which we assume to be around 70 milliliters at rest. So assuming everything's resting here, we know that we're circulating on average 5 liters of blood per minute by the heart. So go back one more time. 5 liters of blood in circulation. What percent of that is water? 55%, right? That's the blood plasma. 45% is what?
Red
blood cells, right. So which of those two, the cells or the water, are creating the force inside the vessel? The water. So it's really the cardiac output, you'll notice here, the water in your bloodstream that creates the blood pressure. In fact, cardiac output is your main determinant. It is your number one force that influences your blood pressure. Okay, so let me repeat that. Cardiac output is around 5 liters of blood. 55% of that is going to be your blood plasma. That's mostly water. 45% of that is blood cells. However, it's the blood plasma, the water, that creates the force here that helps to circulate that blood. So I put this up here. I've stood in front of it. I hope it's seeped into your subconscious, you know, and you'll see that come test day. So I want to repeat, there's actually two things that influence cardiac output: heart rate, stroke volume. And we're now talking about cardiac output being the number one influence for blood pressure. I'm getting ready to talk to you, though, about peripheral resistance. That's not Puerto Rico. That's PR for peripheral resistance. So let's talk through that. You so far so good? Okay. So cardiac output is the number one determinant of blood pressure. It's mostly the fluid in our blood that's creating the force. That's what's creating the push behind this blood. Of course, the heart has to pump that blood. But there's another factor that influences blood pressure, and it's called peripheral resistance. And in plain English, what does peripheral resistance mean? Yeah, how it's moving, right. If I make it hard for you to move down the hallways, I'm giving you resistance, right? So if there was junk littering the hallways and people grabbing at you as you walk down the hallways, they're providing resistance to you moving down the hallway. Same thing with blood. Anything that blocks your flow, anything that impedes you from getting from one point to another, is what we call the resistance. And of course, it is peripheral. We're not talking about resistance around the heart. We're talking about resistance in your systemic vessels. So we've got blood viscosity, vessel length, and vessel diameter. Let me talk you through these three. So before we talk about blood viscosity, just visualize for a moment a milkshake. You like milkshakes? Okay. You have your ideal milkshake in mind, right? So if a milkshake is really, really thick, you have to suck really hard on your straw to pull the milkshake through the straw, assuming you use a straw, right? So if you have to work really hard because it's really thick, the same thing applies to the heart. The thicker the blood, the harder the heart has to work to circulate that blood. So what might make blood really thick?
Dehydration.
That's one thing. What's something else that'll influence the viscosity or thickness of your blood?
High red blood cell count.
Good, high red blood cell count. So going back to blood for just a moment, we know that 55% of your blood is water or plasma, 45% are red blood cells. Anything you do to change volume of water or red blood cells to make your blood thicker is going to increase the viscosity of your blood. So what was that condition called where you had too many red blood cells?
Polycythemia.
Good, polycythemia. So if you've got polycythemia, if you're dehydrated, you're going to increase your blood viscosity. And what happens to your heart?
Has to work harder.
Has to work harder, right. And your blood pressure also will go up, right. So increased viscosity is things like, you know, polycythemia, dehydration, anything that balances you toward a more thick blood setting, it's going to cause your heart to work harder, your blood pressure to increase. Anything that swings you the other direction, which is, you know, maybe lower number of red blood cells, things of that sort, maybe in fact cause your heart to have to work less hard. So most of our problems, though, swing us toward things like increased viscosity. Let's also talk about vessel length. We've got miles and miles of blood vessels in us. And of course, the only way to push that blood through is by the contraction and beating of the heart. The farther we get from the heart, the lower that blood pressure is going to be. All right, so vessel length, you know, I use the analogy here of if you have the choice of drinking your milkshake with a regular drinking straw versus a garden hose, doesn't matter how big the diameter is, it matters how long that straw or that hose is. Nobody wants to drink their milkshake through a garden hose, right? You would be sucking on your garden hose for probably a day. So length here matters in terms of blood pressure. The longer you have to force the blood, the further from the heart it has to get. What has to happen to your blood pressure to get it way far away? Gotta be higher, right? If you have short blood vessels, your blood pressure can remain normal. So for who does this matter?
Big, tall people.
Big, tall people, yep. So if you've got big, tall people, you've got longer vessels and your heart has to work harder, right? This is why they say excess weight can cause our hearts to beat harder and our blood pressure to go up. You're having to work the blood through longer miles, more miles of vessels. And the harder you work, of course, that wears out the heart and that causes blood pressure to beat up those vessels on the inside. So that's why they say losing weight can actually reduce your blood pressure. A small loss of weight can have big impacts on blood pressure because we're reducing the number of miles of blood vessels we're having to pump blood through.
Yeah, because fat is vascular.
Fat is vascular, yep. Unfortunately. All right, and our last one is vessel diameter. Okay, so we talked about these terms the other day. Let me remind you, I'm talking most specifically right now about arteries, muscular arteries, and arterioles. Why am I not talking? Why don't we care at all about venules and veins right now?
They don't have a lot of muscle.
They don't have a lot of muscle, right. And what's the pressure in venules and veins?
Zero.
Like zero, right? So they're not interesting.
They're just tubes.
They're just tubes, yeah. So our conversation right now is about arterioles and those muscular arteries. They have smooth muscle in their walls. They can constrict, which means they contract. And when they constrict, what happens to the opening of your vessel?
Smaller.
Gets smaller. So it's squeezing your vessel. We call that vasoconstriction. Okay? We call that squeezing vasoconstriction. When you squeeze your vessels, what happens to your blood pressure?
Goes up.
Yep. So if you're uptight, same thing happens to us. This happens to our vessels. When you're uptight, your blood pressure goes up. Vessels constrict, decreasing diameter. You increase the blood pressure. Now, vessels can relax. If they relax, we call that what?
Vasodilation.
Vasodilation. And when they relax, what happens to the diameter? Opens up, gets bigger. And you've got more blood that can flow through, and blood pressure will now decrease because you're not having to fight to get through this tiny squeezed vessel. So just thinking here, big picture for a moment, what kind of state of mind would vasoconstrict your vessels? Would you be in like sympathetic mode or parasympathetic mode?
Sympathetic.
Yeah, sympathetic mode could put you here. So we do know that there's other things that can influence your blood vessel diameter, you know, your state of mind, what kind of experiences you're currently having. That can cause the vessels to constrict or to dilate. Okay, so I want to mention now, and I'll mention again several times, there is sympathetic stimulation. There's innervation to your vessels that can cause them to constrict, but there's actually not parasympathetic innervation to your vessels. That's really important to make note of because you can immediately, you know, constrict those vessels and increase your pressure. That's life or death, right? You got to get the blood going where it needs to go. But how do you make them relax if there's no parasympathetic innervation? How do you make a vessel relax if there's no parasympathetic innervation?
You have to relax. Mm-hmm.
You have to relax. So let me put it to you this way. If you don't have a brake pedal in your car, the only way to slow down is to take your foot off the gas pedal, right? And eventually you'll just coast to stopping. If you had a brake pedal, that's like the parasympathetic nervous system, you can put the brake on and stop the car. But since we have no parasympathetic innervation to our vessels, the only thing you can stop doing is being
tense.
Yeah, stop being in sympathetic mode. So that's why constant stress that puts us into sympathetic mode, you just have to get off that hamster wheel and let your body relax naturally because there's no way to naturally make your vessels open back up. That's wicked, isn't it? Okay. So let me flip you over to 54. So I'd like to show you this picture for a reason, and we're going to focus right now on the brain. On the top of page 54, you'll notice an old friend, the medulla oblongata, is mentioned. There is an automatically controlled center here called the cardiovascular center. It's housed in the medulla oblongata. Like the name implies, cardiovascular includes a component for the heart, that's cardio, and of course, for the blood vessels and pressure, that's the vascular component. So the cardiac center is a part of your cardiovascular center in the medulla, and you'll notice it controls heart rate. The vasomotor center is part of the cardiovascular center, but its job is to control arterial vessel diameter, and that now controls blood pressure. So we actually have an override for our heart. You know, the heart's intrinsic conduction system sets a pace of around 75 beats per minute. But we now know where the override comes from. It comes from the medulla oblongata and specifically the cardiovascular center. The cardiovascular center is one component there, that cardiac center is the one that can override your heart rate and cause it to speed up or slow down. All right, so that next bullet point is something worth noticing. You'll notice it says the cardiovascular center transmits impulses along sympathetic pathways to both the heart and to your vessels. What do you think this sympathetic pathway tells to your SA node?
Go faster.
Go faster, right. So if you need to increase heart rate for whatever reason, that of course is going to be told to that SA node. Now, if you want to increase blood pressure, what do you do to their diameter?
Constrict,
right. So it's a two-pronged approach in terms of how the sympathetic nervous system acts on heart rate and blood pressure. If you read along, though, it says parasympathetic innervation is only wired to which of those two locations? Just the heart, right. Okay, so you'll notice there's no parasympathetic innervation to our vessels. So you can speed up heart rate, you can slow down heart rate, but the only thing you can do to your vessels is vasoconstrict them through sympathetic activity. You don't actually have parasympathetic innervation to your vessels. Okay, so this is kind of where we're heading. We're talking about controlling heart rate and blood pressure. And the controlling override center is found in what part of your brain?
Medulla
oblongata. Good. And the cardiovascular center has two components, a cardiac center and a vasomotor center. Good. And which one controls or overrides heart rate? Cardiac center. And does it include sympathetic and parasympathetic? Yeah, cardiac has both. It's got sympathetic and parasympathetic. How about vasomotor? Only sympathetic, right. Okay, so now I should tell you about this. The heart has built-in receptors. These receptors are feeding information back to that cardiovascular center in your brain. One type of receptor found there is a pressure receptor. It's called a baroreceptor. Could you give me a number that might cause warning for your brain in terms of pressure in the heart?
180.
180. That sends a signal to the brain that says, oh, we've got high pressure. The heart can control that pressure by changing the way it beats or its contractility. We also could have a pressure of 40, right? 40 millimeters mercury. That may send a message to the brain. So if there's something out of range, then these baroreceptors increase their signaling to the brain, to that medulla oblongata, and in turn, we can either increase heart rate or we can decrease heart rate. So let me just kind of walk you through an example of what may happen here. Let's say that we are extremely scared, we are just have the fright of our life, and your heart's beating really hard, your pressure's up, the baroreceptor here carries information to your medulla oblongata. And your medulla oblongata is, of course, you know, overwhelmed because you're in the sympathetic mode all of a sudden. How do you slow down the heart rate?
Faint.
You just might, right? So what mode do you want to put yourself back in to slow that heart rate?
Parasympathetic.
Yeah, put yourself back in parasympathetic mode. So if you can at all calm yourself down, you know, you can put yourself in that frame of mind that everything's okay, it really wasn't that big of a deal after all, then you can put which nerve here back in control of overriding heart rate?
Vagus
nerve. Or like we talked the other day, hold your breath. That can help, you know, slow down that heart rate and decrease the pressure. So yeah, there is parasympathetic innervation to the heart. Vagus nerve tells the SA node to slow down. It releases which neurotransmitter on the SA node?
Acetylcholine.
Good. All right. So high blood pressure, low blood pressure. Notice we're not measuring heart rate here. It's pressure that we're tattletaling back to the brain about, not heart rate. So it's the blood pressure that is creating a feedback loop for the brain and back to the heart. Okay? Let's talk about the second thing, chemoreceptors. Chemoreceptors are chemical receptors, and it is their job to detect the chemistry of your blood. So in terms of chemicals, there's a couple of really important chemicals in your bloodstream. Oxygen, right? What's another really important chemical?
Carbon dioxide.
Yeah, carbon dioxide. And
hydrogen.
So why hydrogen? What could that do to you? What does that do to pH?
Raise it or lower.
Raise it or lower, right. So you probably haven't had this yet, but CO2 drives hydrogen ion levels. The more CO2 you've got, the more hydrogens you have. The more hydrogens you have, the lower your pH goes. That's kind of into respiratory, but for now we'll take it at face value that CO2 levels, hydrogen levels, and oxygen levels all influence our chemoreceptors who tattletale back to the brain. So let's say somebody has fallen, maybe hit themselves in the head, and they're breathing more slowly right now, and their oxygen levels are starting to drop, and their CO2 is starting to increase, and they're becoming a little bit acidic. So in this case, should a baroreceptor or a chemoreceptor deliver the message to the brain?
Chemoreceptor.
And it sounds like we have need for the brain to be notified, so the message goes up here to the brain. The medulla is notified, and the message comes back down, not by vagus nerve, but we come with epinephrine this time. What are we going to tell the heart to do?
Speed it up.
Why?
Because you need more blood flow to carry that oxygen.
Yeah, you've got a little bit of oxygen. You need the heart to beat faster, to circulate it more quickly, and hopefully get more oxygen to those cells and tissues. So the message for something like low oxygen levels, high CO2, or acid conditions will trigger an increase in heart rate. What do you think we're also telling our vessels to do at the very same time?
Constrict.
Right. Make them squeeze, and when they squeeze, where does your blood pressure go?
Up.
It goes up. So if you've got just a little bit of oxygen to deliver, you want to make sure you can do it as efficiently as possible, and that's why we have an increase in heart rate and in blood pressure. If you flip the scenario on that chart near the bottom, notice high levels of high levels of O2, low CO2 and alkalosis can also put you into one of these feedback loops. But in this situation, any of those problems will tell your medulla, and the medulla makes the decision that we need to do what to your heart rate? Decrease it. And we do that this time using which nerve?
Vagus
nerve. And what chemical is now released onto the SA node?
Acetylcholine.
Good. Now, here's the catch. You really want your blood pressure to decrease, but you can't really say, hey, you know, there's a parasympathetic innervation to your vessels. So instead of sending acetylcholine to your vessels, you just stop sending what neurotransmitter to your vessels? Epinephrine, right? So you stop sending epinephrine and that will eventually dilate. Okay, so obviously blood pressure is a little slower to respond because we don't have that direct innervation for parasympathetic nerves. Okay, so what I've got for you on page 55 are some problems. Let me work you through the first one there. The first one is a baroreceptor. Right off the bat, are we looking at chemicals in the blood or pressure?
Pressure.
Good. All right, so you'll notice this first scenario, we have polycythemia. That's increased blood viscosity, and that's increased blood pressure. Now that just signals to us that we've got a baroreceptor that's going to be a tattletale. Those baroreceptors here in the aortic arch are going to send a nerve impulse through this nerve back to the medulla oblongata. And the medulla makes the decision on how to handle this. So what should we do about this increased blood pressure? How do we fix the problem?
Slow the heart rate.
So the medulla says, the solution is to activate which nerve?
Vagus
nerve. And it tells your SA node to be more slowly. And we do this using a neurotransmitter. This one's called acetylcholine, right? Can we tell the vessels to relax?
Not directly.
So we can't necessarily say, hey, vessels, you relax too. We just stop stimulating them with epinephrine. And over time, what do they eventually do?
Dilate.
They'll dilate, right. And when vessels dilate, what happens to blood pressure?
Decreases.
Good. Okay, this is a negative feedback loop. Let me give you a moment to read the next problem. This is low blood pressure. And if you would like to go ahead and fill in those four steps, I'll pause here for you. Okay, so for our next problem, low blood pressure is the stimulus. What type of receptor picks up on blood pressure problems?
Baroreceptor.
Good, baroreceptor. Baroreceptors are tattletales, and who do they tattletale to? They send a message up to the cardiovascular center and the medulla oblongata. Good. Okay. The control center is, of course, your medulla, but we're looking specifically at that cardiovascular center. If you've got low blood pressure, the response of the cardiovascular center is to do what?
Increase sympathetic stimulation.
Good. Increase sympathetic stimulation and decrease parasympathetic. So what happens to the firing of your SA node?
Fire more rapidly.
More rapidly, yeah, faster. So heart rate will go up. Good. And likewise, we are going to squeeze those vessels. So we send increased epinephrine to the vessels. They constrict. And when they constrict, what happens to blood pressure?
Increases.
Goes up too. Good. So keep in mind, it's a two-pronged approach. We tell the heart rate to increase. We tell the vessels to constrict. And so the effector, the response there is, of course, SA node fires more quickly. Heart rate increases, vessels now constrict, BP will go up. I'm going to leave the other three there for you guys to work on as a homework, and then we'll do the answers on Tuesday. And for just the last few minutes, I'd like to get you a little bit onto page 56. Do you have any questions on how to work those problems? Okay. So heart rate and blood pressure is complicated. We just saw one mechanism for overriding built-in heart rate, and that's, of course, using the medulla oblongata. But there's a bunch of other stuff that can influence heart rate and blood pressure. So at the very top of your page there, you'll notice there is short-term control of blood pressure. Three main chemicals there that we've listed. One of them is histamine. Whoa, thinking way back to blood, what kind of cell releases histamine?
Basophils.
Good. And basophils are involved in what we call an immune response or an inflammatory response. They will make your vessels leak like crazy, and unfortunately that's bad news, because when your vessels leak, where does the blood plasma now go? Goes out into those cells and tissues. Now, if your blood vessels are leaking and you're losing plasma, where does your blood pressure go?
Down.
This is bad news because histamine, of course, can vasodilate. It can initially drop your blood pressure. Well,
shock.
There comes baroreceptors in, right? Because then they'll try to increase it with epinephrine. It just becomes this massive feedback loop to fix what basophils are doing to your blood pressure. You're right, this can lead to anaphylactic shock, bad news there, but histamine's a really potent chemical. Antihistamines can reverse the effects of it. Even Pepcid can also work against histamine. So pretty potent chemical there that vasodilates, makes your vessels leak. Nitrous oxide also is a vasodilator. It's something that your vessels make themselves, and it relaxes your vessels and lowers your blood pressure. So we also know that you can get nitrous oxide in the form of laughing gas. Of course, that makes a person relax, lowers their blood pressure. So if you're going into dental hygiene or dental assisting, of course, that's something you may encounter is laughing gas or nitrous. So why might we monitor someone's heart rate if they're given nitrous oxide? Yeah, blood pressure could bottom out, right? And so we want to make sure their heart rate's still delivering enough oxygen to their cells and tissues. All right, and then last there, nicotine is a potent vasoconstrictor, meaning it does what to your vessels? Good. And your blood pressure goes up. Yep. All right, so nasty little histamine reaction there. Of course, nitrous can come from laughing gas or huffing chemicals. All right, and then of course cigarettes are a pretty reliable source of nicotine. All right, so where we'll come back to on Tuesday is I'll review the answers for page 55 with you, and then we'll cover the hormonal controls of blood pressure. The big topic for Tuesday is going to be on page 58, so if you'd like to pre-read, we're heading into bulk fluid transport come Wednesday.